Today's reading of the New York Times has been made available by the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired.
This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, my name is John Zinser, and this is the New York Times NewsHour for today, Friday, April 26th, 2024. Our first article. Conservative justices appear poised to rule ex-presidents have some level of immunity. Such a ruling would probably send the case back to a lower court and could delay any trial until after the November election. This article is by Adam Liptak. The Supreme Court's conservative majority appeared ready on Thursday to rule that former presidents have some degree of immunity from criminal prosecution, a move that could further delay the criminal case against former President Donald J. Trump on charges that he plotted to subvert the 2020 election. Such a ruling would most likely send the case back to the trial court, ordering it to draw distinctions between official and private conduct. It would amount to a major statement on the scope of presidential power. Though there was seeming consensus among the justices that the case could eventually go forward based on Mr. Trump's private actions, the additional proceedings could make it hard to conduct the trial before the 2024 election. There were only glancing references to the timing of the trial and no particular sense of urgency among the more conservative justices at Thursday's argument. Instead, several of them criticized what they suggested was a political prosecution brought under laws they said were ill-suited to the case at hand. If the court effectively blocks a prompt trial, particularly after it acted quickly in March to restore Mr. Trump to the ballot in Colorado, it will surely ignite furious criticism from liberals and others who view the former president's actions as an assault on democracy and the rule of law. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., who understands himself to be the custodian of the court's prestige and legitimacy, did not tip his hand very much, though he seemed deeply skeptical of the decision from a unanimous three-judge panel of an appeals court in Washington rejecting Mr. Trump's immunity claim. The appeals court ruled, he said, quoting from its decision, that a former president can be prosecuted for his official acts, quote, because the fact of the prosecution means that the former president has allegedly acted in defiance of the laws, end quote. Michael R. Dreeben, a lawyer on the special counsel's team, said the passage was tautological, a term the Chief Justice seized on. Quote, why shouldn't we either send it back to the Court of Appeals or issue an opinion making clear that that's not the law? Chief Justice Roberts asked. Such further proceedings would take time, of course. If Mr. Trump prevails in the election, he could order the Justice Department to drop the charges. The argument, which lasted more than 2.5 hours, was largely focused on whether Mr. Trump and other presidents could be prosecuted for their official conduct and on how to tell the difference between those actions and private ones. Dr. John Sauer, Mr. Trump's lawyer, argued for an expansive understanding. In answer to hypothetical questions, he said that presidential orders to murder political rivals or stage a coup could well be subject to immunity. But several of the conservative justices seemed disinclined to consider those questions or the details of the accusations against Mr. Trump. They said the court should issue a ruling that applies to presidential power generally. Quote, we're writing a rule for the ages, end quote, Justice Neil M. Gorsuch said. Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh also said the court should think about the larger message of its decision. Quote, "This case has huge implications for the presidency, for the future of the presidency, for the future of the country," end quote. He said, adding, quote, "It's going to cycle back and be used against the current president or the next president," end quote. Justice Samuel A. Alito, Jr., in an inversion of the conventional understanding of the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol, said that a ruling for Mr. Trump could enhance democratic values. Quote, "A stable democratic society requires that a candidate who loses an election, even a close one, even a hotly contested one, leave office peacefully," end quote, he said, adding that the prospect of criminal prosecution would make that less likely. Quote, "Will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy?" he asked. Quote, "And we can look around the world and find countries where we have seen this process, where the loser gets thrown in jail." Justice Gorsuch identified what he said was another negative consequence of allowing prosecutions of former presidents. Quote, "It seems to me like one of the incentives that might be created is for presidents to try to pardon themselves," end quote, he said. Justice Sonia Sotomayor said she had a different understanding. Quote, "A stable democratic society," end quote, she said, quote, "needs the good faith of its public officials," end quote. If there was a member of the court's six-justice conservative majority who seemed ready to send at least a part of the case to trial in the near future, it was Justice Amy Coney Barrett. She elicited concessions from Mr. Sauer that, for instance, Mr. Trump's use of, quote, "a private attorney who was willing to spread knowingly false claims of election fraud to spearhead his challenge to new election results," end quote, was private conduct. Mr. Dreeben, the government lawyer, said it was beyond question that parts of the case concerned private conduct. Quote, "When working with private lawyers and a private public relations advisor to gin up fraudulent slates of electors," end quote, Mr. Dreeben said, quote, "that is not any part of a president's job," end quote. Mr. Trump is accused of a sprawling effort to overturn the outcome of the 2020 election, including by seeking to recruit bogus slates of electors in a bid to alter vote counts and pressuring an array of officials, like Vice President Mike Pence, to subvert the results. Mr. Trump faces a count of conspiring to defraud the government, another of conspiring to disenfranchise voters, and two counts related to corruptly obstructing a congressional proceeding. The case before the court involves just one of four sets of pending criminal charges against Mr. Trump, including those at issue in a trial underway in state court in Manhattan over accusations of hush money payments meant to skew the 2016 election. Whatever happens after Thursday's argument, the 2024 election will take place in the shadow of the criminal justice system. Justice Alito proposed a broad principle to distinguish official and unofficial conduct. Quote, "Suppose," end quote, he said, quote, "the rule were that a former president cannot be prosecuted for official acts unless no plausible justification could be imagined for what the president did, taking into account history and legal precedent," end quote. Justice Sotomayor objected, saying that, quote, "plausible," end quote, is little different from absolute. Quote, "What is plausible about the president insisting and creating a fraudulent slate of electoral candidates?" end quote, she asked. The two lawyers on Thursday faced many questions about which of Mr. Trump's acts were official and which private. They drew different lines, but neither took a categorical position. Justice Kavanaugh said more work needed to be done. Quote, "The president is subject to prosecution for all personal acts, just like every other American for personal acts," end quote, he said. Quote, "The question is, acts taken in an official capacity," end quote. Lower courts, he said, should sort out which is which. The court has heard two other cases this term concerning the January 6th attack on the Capitol. In March, the court unanimously rejected an attempt to bar Mr. Trump from the ballot under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which made people who engage in insurrection ineligible to hold office. The court, without discussing whether Mr. Trump was covered by the provision, ruled that states may not use it to exclude candidates for the presidency from the ballot. Last week, the court heard arguments in a challenge to the use of a federal obstruction law to prosecute members of the mob that stormed the Capitol. Two of the four charges against Mr. Trump are based on the obstruction law. The justice seemed skeptical that the law, which was a reaction to an accounting scandal, applied to the rioters' actions. That skepticism was evident on Thursday, too, with Justice Gorsuch recasting the January 6th assault to illustrate what he suggested was a misuse of the law. Quote, "Let's say a president leads a mostly peaceful protest sit-in in front of Congress because he objects to a piece of legislation that's going through," Justice Gorsuch said. Quote, "And in fact, delays the proceedings of Congress." He added, quote, "So a president then could be prosecuted for the conduct I described after he leaves office?" End quote. His tone suggested that the answer must be no. The second article today, Harvey Weinstein conviction overturned by New York Court of Appeals. In a staggering 4-3 decision, the state's highest court overturned the conviction of the disgraced movie producer who, in 2020, was found guilty of 2 felony sex crimes. This article is by Michael Wilson, Jonah E. Bromwich, Jan Ransom, and Nicole Hong. New York's highest court on Thursday overturned the felony sex crimes conviction of the notorious Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, a staggering reversal of a bedrock case in the hashtag MeToo era that prompted countless victims of sexual harassment and assault to come forward as accusers. In a bitterly contested 4-3 decision, the New York Court of Appeals found that the judge who had presided over Mr. Weinstein's case deprived him of a fair trial in 2020 by allowing prosecutors to call witnesses who said Mr. Weinstein had assaulted them, but whose accusations were not the basis for any of the charges against him. Responding on Thursday, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin L. Bragg, announced that he would seek to prosecute Mr. Weinstein again. Quote, "We will do everything in our power to retry this case and remain steadfast in our commitment to survivors of sexual assault," end quote, a spokeswoman for Mr. Bragg's office said. The case was originally prosecuted by his predecessor, Cyrus R. Vance, Jr. Mr. Weinstein, 72, the immediate impact of the ruling might amount to little more than a change of scenery. He is likely to be transferred from the prison in Rome, New York, where he has been held since 2020, to a facility nearer to New York City, where he will await the filing of new charges. But the opinion also raised questions about whether a separate conviction in California on rape and sexual assault charges can survive a similar legal challenge. That case, which saw Mr. Weinstein sentenced to another 16 years in prison in 2022, also relied in part on witnesses whose accusations did not lead to charges. Mr. Weinstein's lawyer in the California case said she planned to file an appeal next month. Quote, "Our office had representatives in New York during the trial, and we are aware of the extreme difficulties the victims faced while testifying about the traumas that Mr. Weinstein caused them," end quote, the representative said, adding, quote, "We are confident that our convictions will withstand the appellate scrutiny." The decision to overturn the New York conviction, while shocking to many, had been anticipated in legal circles. The criminal case against Mr. Weinstein had been viewed as fragile since the day it was filed, and prosecutors were believed to have taken risky, boundary-pushing bets to see it through. Still, the ruling was met with expressions of shock and anger by some of Mr. Weinstein's accusers. Ashley Judd, the first actress to come forward with allegations against Mr. Weinstein, called it, quote, "unfair to survivors," end quote. Quote, "We still live in our truth," end quote, Ms. Judd said on Thursday, quote, "and we know what happened," end quote. Mr. Weinstein's lawyer, Arthur Adala, said his client learned of the decision when he was handed a news report on a slip of paper by someone in the prison facility. Quote, "He said thank you more times than I can count," end quote, said Mr. Idala, who spoke to Mr. Weinstein by phone Thursday morning. Quote, "Harvey was very gracious, very grateful," end quote. The former producer's health has been steadily declining in recent years. He has diabetes, eye problems, and heart issues, has used a walker, and was housed in a medical unit at the prison, the Mohawk Correctional Facility. Quote, "He has been going through bouts of difficulty," end quote, said a spokesman, Judah Engelmeyer. Mr. Weinstein has been a sharp-elbowed titan in the film industry, rising to power in the 1990s behind a stream of critically lauded blockbuster movies under the Miramax label. His downfall, after lurid accusations emerged from dozens of actresses and former colleagues, became a primer for how the world viewed and treated many once powerful men who used their positions for sex. Mr. Weinstein was accused of sexual misconduct by more than 100 women. But in New York, he was convicted of raping an aspiring actress, Jessica Mann, and assaulting a television production assistant, Miriam Haley, and sentenced to 23 years in prison. Thursday's decision did not discount the credibility of the accusations against him. Rather, it found fault with the admission of the testimony of women whose descriptions of abuse fell outside the criminal case. Prosecutors in sexual assault and other cases often seek to use them to establish a pattern of behavior. But doing so risks unfairly influencing the jury because the defendant is supposed to be judged only on the crimes he is charged with. For that reason, judges seek to limit such testimony. And the judge in Mr. Weinstein's case, Justice James M. Burke, did not permit the prosecutors to call as many of those witnesses as they had hoped to, but he did allow a handful to testify. The appeals court said that he should not have. Quote, "It is an abuse of judicial discretion to permit untested allegations of nothing more than bad behavior that destroys a defendant's character," end quote, Judge Jenny Rivera wrote on behalf of the majority. Quote, "But sheds no light on their credibility as related to the criminal charges," end quote. Donna Rotuno, Mr. Weinstein's lead trial lawyer in New York, praised the ruling on Thursday. Quote, "They were prosecuting him for sins, not crimes," end quote, she said. Quote, This speaks to our justice system as a whole. The court ruling says to prosecutors, winning at all costs is not your job. Your job is to put on a fair trial. End quote. The Court of Appeals also faulted the trial judge for permitting prosecutors to question the producer about uncharged allegations, spanning back decades, if he decided to take the stand. He did not testify. Dawn Dunning, one of the women who prosecutors called to the stand, even though Mr. Weinstein had not been charged with assaulting her, said on Thursday that she had no regrets. Quote, "I am still proud that I testified and confronted that convicted rapist," end quote, Ms. Dunning said in a statement, adding, quote, "I am a stronger person for having done so, and I know that other women found strength and courage because I and other Weinstein survivors confronted him publicly," end quote. Quote, "The culture has changed," end quote, she said. Quote, "And I am confident that there is no going back," end quote. In 2022, after a vigorous debate by the justices, a lower appeals court upheld Mr. Weinstein's conviction. They wrote that the testimony from the additional witnesses had been instrumental in showing that the producer did not see his victims as, quote, "romantic partners or friends," end quote, but that, quote, "his goal at all times was to position the women in such a way that he could have sex with them, and that whether the women consented or not was irrelevant to him," end quote. In a quietly dramatic twist, this February, when New York's highest court heard the producer's latest and final appeal, four of the seven judges were women, and Thursday's majority ruling included three female judges. Their decision landed with stinging dissents. Quote, "Fundamental understandings of sexual violence perpetrated by men known to and with significant power over the women they victimize are on full display in the majority's opinion," end quote, Judge Madeline Singas wrote. The decision to overturn promised to launch fresh debate about the ground rules for criminal convictions in sexual misconduct cases. Quote, "The hashtag MeToo movement showed how important it is to have accounts from multiple accusers," end quote, said Deborah Turkerheimer, a former Manhattan prosecutor who is now a professor at the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. But witness rules, which are strict for a reason, can transform courtrooms into an, quote, "alternate universe in which evidence relevant to sex crimes is often kept from the jury," end quote. Quote, "There's a tension at the heart of it," end quote, she said, quote, "and prosecution in the hashtag MeToo era will continue to deal with this dilemma," end quote. The third article today, juggling campaign and foreign policy, Biden sends complicated messages. The president signed a bill that could ban TikTok, even as his reelection team uses it to reach young voters. It was hardly the first internal disparity on matters around the globe. This article is by Peter Baker. President Biden just signed a bill that could ban President Biden from using TikTok. But Mr. Biden plans to keep using TikTok until Mr. Biden's new law forces Mr. Biden off it. His political team in Wilmington, Delaware, after all, considers TikTok a vital tool to reach young voters who could be crucial to his chances of winning re-election this fall. The problem is that his national security team in Washington considers the Chinese-owned social media site a threat to America that should be banned if it is not sold. Reconciling those two imperatives left Mr. Biden's government and campaign advisors laboring on Wednesday to explain the competing rationales. But it is not the only time that campaign Joe and foreign policy Joe have been at odds in recent months. Campaign Joe tells stories on the trail that foreign policy Joe's staff then has to clean up or try to ignore as best as possible. Campaign Joe prefers blunt talk. Foreign policy Joe has to worry about diplomacy. The disconnect is hardly unprecedented in an election year. Every president seeking a second term finds himself juggling two different jobs with two different imperatives at the same time: running the country and running for office. A candidate is focused on firing up supporters and tearing down the other side. A commander-in-chief has to worry about what might be best for the nation, even if it is not necessarily best for his electoral chances. Still, the disparity between Washington and Wilmington has been on display lately. When former President Donald J. Trump hosted Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary at Mar-a-Lago, Mr. Trump's Florida estate and club, Mr. Biden's Delaware-based campaign assailed Mr. Orban as, quote, a dictator, end quote. The White House, however, refused to use that term for a NATO ally. Just last week, Mr. Biden told two campaign audiences that after being shot down during World War II, his uncle might have been eaten by cannibals in Papua New Guinea. Unsurprisingly, that rather peeved the island nation's leaders at a time when the president has been courting them as part of his Indo-Pacific strategy. Quote, like most effective incumbent presidents, President Biden can navigate doing two things at once, being commander-in-chief and barnstorming the battlegrounds, taking his popular and historic agenda to the voters who will decide this election. End quote. Kevin Munoz, a campaign spokesman, said in a statement, quote, it's a stark contrast to Trump, who couldn't manage the day job when he was in office and can't seem to wake up to the fact that he's running on a deeply toxic agenda that will lose him the election again in November, end quote. Problematic, offhand remarks have long been a challenge for Mr. Biden, who once called himself, quote, a gaffe machine, end quote. Campaigns result in more opportunities to go off script than speaking off a teleprompter in the East Room, so the White House cleanup squad invariably has a surge in business at this point in the electoral cycle. It was at a campaign fundraiser last year that Mr. Biden referred to President Xi Jinping of China as, quote, a dictator, end quote, just a day after Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken had met with Mr. Xi in Beijing in an effort to smooth over friction in the U.S.-Chinese relationship. When Mr. Biden was later asked at a news conference if he would still call Mr. Xi a dictator, he said, quote, well, look, he is, end quote. And Mr. Blinken, sitting nearby, appeared to wince. Not that anyone in Washington would privately dispute that Mr. Xi is a dictator, but as a matter of timing, saying it out loud complicated Mr. Blinken's diplomacy. As it happens, Mr. Blinken seems to have remarkable timing when it comes to these things. Where was the secretary on Wednesday when Mr. Biden signed the TikTok legislation? He had just landed in Beijing for more talks with Chinese leaders. Mr. Orban is another leader widely considered a dictator in Washington, but because he leads a treaty ally of the United States, official criticism of his policies cracking down on democracy is usually more measured. Not so when Mr. Orban met with Mr. Trump last month. Quote, Donald Trump is kicking off the general election, end quote, by welcoming rogues like, quote, Hungarian dictator Viktor Orban, end quote, the Biden campaign said in an emailed statement. Mr. Biden himself, at a later campaign stop, did not go quite that far, but referred to Mr. Orban as someone, quote, looking for dictatorship. The statements prompted outrage in Budapest, where Mr. Orban's government summoned the U.S. ambassador to protest. Quote, we are not obliged to tolerate such lies from anyone, even if that person happens to be the President of the United States of America, end quote. Foreign Minister Peter Szijjártó complained at a news conference. That left Jake Sullivan, the president's national security advisor, in the awkward position of declining to say whether Mr. Orban is a dictator. Quote, I'm not going to speak on behalf of the Biden campaign, end quote, he told reporters at a briefing. Quote, you should direct those questions to the campaign, end quote. He did express, quote, our deep concerns about Hungary's assault on democratic institutions, end quote. Heather A. Conley, the president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a research group that promotes democracy, noted that Mr. Orban had injected himself into America's politics, attending the Conservative Political Action Conference and declaring after his Mar-a-Lago visit that it would be, quote, better for Hungary if Mr. Trump returned to power. Quote, tragically, Hungary has become both a foreign policy and a campaign issue, end quote, she said. Still, she added, calling Mr. Orban a dictator has concrete foreign policy implications. Quote, should a NATO member head of state government be declared a dictator, the country would be placed in a special penalty box until the dictatorship is over, end quote, she said, recalling the military junta that took over Greece from 1967 to 1974. Last week's presidential cannibal storytelling provoked a backlash of its own. Mr. Biden was talking about his uncle's death in World War II. Quote, he got shot down in New Guinea, and they never found the body because there used to be, there were a lot of cannibals, for real, in that part of New Guinea, end quote, he said at one stop. Never mind that the story does not even appear to be true. According to Pentagon records, his uncle, Second Lieutenant Ambrose J. Finnegan, was a passenger on a military plane that crashed in the Pacific off the northern coast of what was then the territory of New Guinea on May 14, 1944, after its engines failed. Mr. Finnegan and two crew members disappeared and were presumed dead, but the report does not indicate that the plane was shot down, much less than anyone encountered cannibals. The president's comments did not go over well in Papua New Guinea, with whom Mr. Biden has been trying to strengthen relations as part of his effort to counter Chinese aggression in the region. Quote, President Biden's remarks may have been a slip of the tongue. However, my country does not deserve to be labeled as such, end quote, Prime Minister James Marpe said. Gordon Peake, an expert in the region at the United States Institute of Peace, said the flap was a reminder that comments could have unintended consequences. Quote, Papua New Guinea and the wider Pacific, traditionally a bit of a diplomatic backwater for the major powers, is now something of a seller's market as competition ramps up, end quote, he said. Quote, so words are mattering now more than ever, end quote. The new TikTok law was part of a $95 billion foreign aid measure to provide arms to Ukraine and Israel for their ongoing wars and to bolster Taiwan against possible Chinese aggression. Under the law, TikTok's Chinese owner, ByteDance, has to sell within 270 days, or about 9 months, or shut down operations in the United States because of concerns over sensitive privacy information and propaganda. the president can extend that deadline to a year. That means that Mr. Biden's campaign can continue to use TikTok through the November election. Mr. Sullivan, the national security advisor, declined to say whether the campaign should leave the platform in the meantime. Quote, "I'm going to let campaigns decide for themselves what they're going to do," end quote, he told reporters on Wednesday. Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House press secretary, emphasized that TikTok did not necessarily face a ban if it could find a buyer. Quote, "We want to see divestment," end quote, she said. "We want to see it being sold, and we do not seek a ban," end quote. She added that the White House was not urging anyone to leave the platform in the interim. Quote, "We're not saying that we do not want Americans to use TikTok," end quote, she said. Quote, "We want to make sure it's done in a way that we protect our national security and we protect Americans," end quote. But in fact, the Biden administration has told some Americans not to use TikTok, or at least limited how they use it. Last year, it banned federal employees from having TikTok on their government devices, a rule that applied to federal contractors and any personnel devices used for federal work. The bill that Mr. Biden signed on Wednesday exemplified the conflict between foreign policy and electoral considerations. Not only did he risk alienating millions of young people who use TikTok, but the measure also included billions of dollars in arms for Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, even though his support for Israel has cost him support among young progressives, outrage by the civilian casualty toll. In his comments on signing the bill, Mr. Biden emphasized that it included money for humanitarian relief in Gaza, but made no mention of TikTok. About 3 hours later, his campaign posted its latest video on TikTok, attacking Mr. Trump. Fourth article for today. In Trump Tower, the president-elect praised the man who kept his secrets. David Pecker, former publisher of the National Enquirer, testified that Donald J. Trump thanked him for burying stories. This article is by Jonah E. Bromwich, Ben Protess, and Michael Rothfield. Days before Donald J. Trump became president in 2017, a cadre of advisors, officials, and allies descended on his office at Trump Tower. A future Secretary of State, his soon-to-be Chief of Staff, the FBI Director, and the publisher of the National Enquirer. The publisher, David Pecker, may have seemed out of place, but he had just performed an indispensable and confidential service to the Trump campaign. He had paid off a Playboy model, Karen McDougal, who had said she had an affair with Mr. Trump, and a doorman who had heard that Mr. Trump had fathered a child out of wedlock. The future president, triumphant, thanked Mr. Pecker for his service. Quote, he said, "I want to thank you for handling the McDougal situation." And then he also said, "I wanted to thank you for the doorman situation," end quote. Mr. Pecker testified at Mr. Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan Thursday, leaving it unclear if anyone else heard the exchange. Quote, he said that the stories could be very embarrassing, end quote. Mr. Trump also asked Miss McDougal, quote, "How's our girl?" end quote. Mr. Pecker said, he replied, quote, "She's cool. She's very quiet. No issues," end quote. That remarkable scene, where Mr. Trump's lofty new status as president-elect collided with his colorful New York habitat, was private until Thursday, when Mr. Pecker recounted it to jurors. He described in vivid detail how Mr. Trump depended on him to buy and bury damaging stories that could have derailed Mr. Trump's campaign, the plot that prosecutors put at the center of the case. Mr. Pecker's testimony, in the first criminal trial of an American president, underscored how his support in 2016 is haunting Mr. Trump in 2024. The former publisher transported jurors into the room at Trump Tower that day in January 2017. He was there alongside four people who would become key figures in the Trump presidency: Sean Spicer, press secretary, Reince Priebus, chief of staff, Mike Pompeo, CIA director, and later Secretary of State, and James Comey, the FBI director, whom Mr. Trump would ultimately fire. Mr. Trump introduced Mr. Pecker to the men and then added slyly that Mr. Pecker probably, quote, knows more than anyone else in this room, end quote. Quote, it was a joke, end quote, Mr. Pecker testified. Quote, unfortunately, they didn't laugh, end quote. On Thursday, however, Mr. Trump chuckled at the defense table. Over nearly 6 hours of testimony on Thursday, Mr. Pecker described how he had helped quash three scandalous stories about Mr. Trump, including by setting in motion a hush money deal with a porn star, Stormy Daniels. That payment is central to the prosecution's case. Prosecutors have charged Mr. Trump with 34 felonies, accusing him of covering up the payoffs to Ms. Daniels. Mr. Pecker's testimony, which kept many jurors rapt as Mr. Trump shifted and slumped in his chair, spoke to a central theme in the prosecution's case. Mr. Pecker, prosecutors contend, joined a three-man conspiracy with Mr. Trump and Michael D. Cohen, the then candidate's personal lawyer. The men, they say, hatched a plot to hide damaging stories from the American people. Mr. Pecker introduced the jury to a dark art in the world of supermarket tabloids, the practice known as, quote, catch and kill, end quote, buying the rights to a story with no intention of publishing it. The National Enquirer used the tactic to silence Ms. McDougal and the doorman with his account of an out-of-wedlock child, which turned out to be false. He took jurors behind the scenes of the shady machinations, detailing how he had bought Ms. McDougal's story for $150,000 and packaged the payment in a deal with other services that she would supposedly provide, including writing columns. Those services, he acknowledged, were camouflaged for what he knew could have been an illegal donation to Mr. Trump's campaign. In a powerful moment for the prosecution, Mr. Pecker acknowledged a clear-cut motive for keeping the model's story under wraps, protecting Mr. Trump's chance of winning the White House. Quote, we didn't want the story to embarrass Mr. Trump or embarrass or hurt the campaign, end quote, Mr. Pecker testified. He also acknowledged that it is unlawful for a corporation to spend money that way to influence the election, another pivotal moment in the early days of the trial. The Federal Election Commission later punished the Enquirer's parent company with fines of $187,000. Mr. Trump's campaign was not sanctioned. The Trump campaign was particularly concerned about Ms. Daniels' story. Mr. Pecker explained to the jury that he had learned Ms. Daniels was looking to sell her story just as Mr. Trump's campaign was reeling from the publication of the, quote, Access Hollywood, unquote, recording, in which Mr. Trump boasted of grabbing women by their genitals. That tape, he said, quote, was very embarrassing, very damaging to the campaign, end quote. Mr. Pecker then told Mr. Cohen, the fixer of Ms. Daniels' efforts to sell her story of having had sex with Mr. Trump. Mr. Cohen ultimately paid her off to the tune of $130,000. Mr. Pecker warned Mr. Cohen that if Ms. Daniels went public, Mr. Trump would be furious. But Mr. Pecker had already shelled out the $150,000 to Ms. McDougal, and he balked at paying Ms. Daniels, leaving it to Mr. Cohen to strike the hush money deal with her. Quote, "After paying out the doorman, after paying out Karen McDougal, we're not paying out any more monies," end quote, Mr. Pecker recalled telling Mr. Cohen. The prosecutors from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office accused Mr. Trump of falsifying business records when reimbursing Mr. Cohen for the $130,000 payment and charged the former president with 34 felonies, one for each check, ledger, and invoice related to the repayment. Mr. Trump denies that he and Ms. Daniels had sex and has said he did nothing wrong. If convicted, he could receive probation or up to 4 years in prison. Although Mr. Pecker was not directly involved in creating the false records, his story was essential to the prosecution case. As he described his interactions with the district attorney's office, Mr. Trump became animated, shaking his head several times in stern disapproval. After prosecutors finished with Mr. Pecker, Mr. Trump's legal team got a crack at cross-examining him. Under questioning from one of Mr. Trump's lawyers, Emile Bove, the tabloid publisher acknowledged that it was a standard practice for his publication to buy stories as leverage for access and interviews with celebrities. He also admitted giving Mr. Trump a heads up about negative stories for years before he ran for president, helping the defense argue that his actions were unrelated to Mr. Trump's status as a candidate. Mr. Bove also briefly attempted to portray the 72-year-old Mr. Pecker as unreliable, pointing to small inconsistencies or omissions in his recounting of the events. But Mr. Pecker remained mostly composed and stuck to the testimony he gave prosecutors. Under questioning from prosecutors, Mr. Pecker spent much of his time on the stand describing the deal with Ms. McDougal, whose lawyer brought the story to the National Enquirer, which then vetted the account. Ms. McDougal, he said, was happy to stay quiet. Quote, "She said she didn't want to be the next Monica Lewinsky," end quote, he explained. Mr. Pecker alerted Mr. Cohen, who then pressed the tabloid to buy her story. When Mr. Pecker expressed concern about who would pay the $150,000, noting that, quote, "This is a very, very large purchase," end quote, Mr. Cohen reassured him. He said, quote, "The boss will take care of it," end quote. And at one point, Mr. Trump and Mr. Pecker spoke directly about the deal, the former publisher testified. Mr. Trump, he said, called Ms. McDougal, quote, "a nice girl," end quote, leading Mr. Pecker to believe that the candidate, quote, "knew who she was," end quote. Mr. Trump was reluctant to pay, and soon Mr. Cohen was waffling as well. Instead, Mr. Cohen persuaded Mr. Pecker to have his company make the payment. He assured him that the boss would pay Mr. Pecker back. Ultimately, when Mr. Cohen created a shell company to repay the tabloid, it was Mr. Pecker who got cold feet amid concerns about the legality of the arrangement. Quote, "The deal is off," end quote, Mr. Pecker said, he told Mr. Cohen. That was not the end of the saga. Just days before the election, the Wall Street Journal published a story revealing the National Enquirer's deal with Ms. McDougal. This prompted an irate call to Mr. Pecker. Quote, "Donald Trump was very upset," end quote, Mr. Pecker said Thursday, describing how the candidate asked, quote, "How could this happen? I thought you had this under control," end quote. Mr. Trump had said, blamed the National Enquirer for leaking the story. Then he hung up. After Mr. Trump's victory, Mr. Pecker encountered him at the Trump Tower meeting in January of 2017, and then in July of that year at the White House. Quote, Mr. Trump asked me to join him in the walk from the Oval Office to the dining area, end quote, Mr. Pecker recalled. And on the walk, Mr. Trump posed a question. Quote, how is Karen doing? End quote. Mr. Pecker replied, quote, she's doing well. She's quiet. Everything's going good. End quote. The next story for today. With new salt and sugar limits, school cafeterias are cringing. Many parents and nutritionists applaud stricter federal regulations, but food companies say the changes could increase costs and waste. This story is by Julie Cresswell. Around 11:40 on a cool spring day in early April, students began to stream into the lunchroom at Haleyville High School in Alabama. Cheerleaders, soccer and baseball players, and other members of the student body filed through the lunch line and sat at their tables. They chatted and laughed about upcoming games, Go Roaring Lions, and prom as they dug into plates of chicken Alfredo, green beans, and salad. Emma Ann Hallman, standing in a corner, watched the teenagers carefully. As the child nutrition director for the Haleyville City School District, she has the job of feeding 1,600 students in pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. For months, Ms. Hallman and other heads of school lunch programs have worried about new federal regulations that would reduce allowable sodium levels and introduce new sugar restrictions for foods served in school cafeterias. A debate has raged, with many parents and nutritionists applauding efforts to make lunches more nutritious, while some school lunch administrations fretted that the result would be less tasty to students, reducing consumption and increasing waste. Quote, we are cringing, as it could result in changes across our menus, end quote, Ms. Hallman said. Quote, we would have to look at the sodium amounts in recipes of some of our students' favorite foods, like chicken wings, hot wings, or even some of the Asian foods, end quote. The job of feeding the nation's schoolchildren has never been easy, but in recent years it has become particularly difficult. Rapid inflation has made it harder for schools to prepare meals at or below the cost of $4.30 per student, the federal reimbursement level for the roughly 30 million students who receive federally subsidized meals. Meanwhile, competition for labor has resulted in higher wages, putting a strain on lunch program budgets and shortages of employees in some cafeterias. Quote, I can't compete with what Amazon is paying, end quote, said Betty Wiggins, the head of nutrition services for the Houston Independent School District, one of the nation's largest school districts, which serves over 200,000 meals a day across 276 locations, likening her program to a quick service restaurant with an annual revenue of $132 million. Ms. Wiggins said about 35% of her budget went to labor costs and half to food. Quote, I've got to pay for all of that with a budget of $4.30 per student. And I have some manufacturers backing out saying they can't make the food at that cost anymore, she said. While far from perfect, cafeterias serve plenty of processed foods, school lunches are arguably much healthier than they were a few years ago, thanks to a signature program geared toward combating childhood obesity and championed by Michelle Obama when she was the First Lady. The Healthy, Hungry-Free Kids Act, passed in 2010, required schools to reduce the calories, fat, and sodium in foods served in cafeterias and to increase offerings of whole grains, fruits, vegetables, and non-fat milk. The new regulations drew sharp criticism, however, and the Trump administration rolled back some of them, such as a prohibition on 1% chocolate milk. But last year, the Biden administration proposed updates that would gradually limit salt and sugar in school lunch foods in an attempt to meet federal dietary standards. On Wednesday, the Agricultural Department made the new rules final after scaling back several provisions in the earlier proposal and shifting the start dates. Instead of gradually cutting sodium in lunch foods by a third from current levels by the fall of 2029, school cafeterias will have to cut sodium levels 15% by the 2027-28 academic year. And for the first time, schools will need to limit the amount of added sugars in cereals and yogurts starting in the 2025-26 academic year. Standing in a Haleyville school district pantry a few weeks ago, Ms. Hallman nodded to boxes containing cups of Cocoa Puffs and Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal. They contain less sugar than the cereals that are bought from grocery stores and poured into bowls at home. Still, she said, many of these foods would most likely be affected by the new rules and have to be reworked by the manufacturer. The label of a Cocoa Puffs cereal bar, for instance, showed it had 8 grams of added sugar, while a frosted strawberry Pop-Tart had 14 grams. Quote, "Breakfast, particularly grab-and-go options, is going to be tricky," end quote, Ms. Hallman said. Quote, "The changes could affect how many times a week we can offer certain items with sugar to the students," end quote. Many nutritionists and health policy watchdog groups say the new rules on sodium and sugar are important, with so many children struggling to have or make nutritious choices outside school. Quote, "The Center for Science in the Public Interest, an advocacy group, applauded the move to decrease the amount of sugar in foods served in schools, but called the smaller reduction in sodium levels a missed opportunity given that 9 out of 10 kids consume too much sodium," end quote. Quote, "Nutrition standards in general are so contentious right now," Megan Maroney, the head of federal child nutrition programs for the group, said in an earlier interview, quote, "But we have to do what the science says is best for the kids' health. I know schools and others are working on razor-thin margins, and it's a tough, thankless job sometimes. But schools and manufacturers need to figure out how to make this happen," end quote. That concludes the New York Times NewsHour for today, Friday, the 26th of April, 2024, from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. My name is John Zinser. Thank you for the pleasure of your company and the honor of your time.